Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, dare to be different. My name is Ismail Briaba. Just wonderful to have all of you in our company, whether it's on via, whether, I beg your pardon, whether it's on Medium Wave 1548, Satellite Islam, or via audio streaming medium. But just wonderful to have all of you tuning in. And we're going to have some lovely conversation this morning. Remember, you can join our conversation every time. The number to dial 854-1548. And we've got a wonderful guest and who has been with us a couple of weeks ago. And that's Michelle Kudze. Now, Michelle has got lots and lots of information to share with us. And she's going to take us through some of the steps that whilst we're looking at the blistering heat, also look at what should we be planting at this time of the year and whether we should be going for those beautiful exotic plants or looking at the more the ones that we find locally, the indigenous ones. Hi, good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Ismail.
Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Yes, blistering heat once again. We've been having the heat for the last couple of days and they say it's set to continue well into next week. Some precautions. Let's talk about that.
Basically, first of all, we need to make sure that we mulch the garden beds. And those of the listeners that don't know what mulch is, it's a thick layer of either straw or bark chips. You can even use macadamia nutshells. You can use peach pits, even shredded newspaper works. And the idea of the mulch is to cover the soil so that the soil remains cool now with this terrible heat. And also it suppresses weeds as well. And it the little bit of moisture that there is retained in the soil so it doesn't dry out so quickly.
Well, thank you very much for that. And Michelle, we have lots of people that are going out in the garden. What sort of precautions should they be taking? You know, going out in the intense heat, they need to be doing certain things. Can you help us along with that?
First of all, sunblock, definitely, and a hat. I always believe in going out in the sun in a hat, and as I say, don't forget the sunblock. And please don't go out in the blistering heat. Rather go out early in the morning or late afternoon. And if you intend planting something, rather plant it early in the morning or late afternoon, not sort of between 11 and 2 in the heat of the day, because obviously the transplant shock for the plant will be that much worse. And also, if you're watering your garden, rather water it early in the morning than at 11 o'clock. Because if you're watering at 11, 12, 1, 2 o'clock, all you're doing is letting all that water that you've put down evaporate. So you're actually just wasting your time and you're chasing your water bill high.
And with regards to hydration, you know, people should be hydrating themselves, keeping a bottle of water and their necks covered, is that right, with either a scarf or some sort of covering, or if they have those, you know, camping hats where they have the flap, you know, coming below the neck. I think some of those things would be important.
Oh, yes, definitely. Now, so one certainly must take precautions for the sun. One doesn't realize how hot it is out there.
Now, while we're talking about the sun and the intensity of the heat, saying that the heat is going to increase and we're going to look well into next week. Having said all of that, we still wanting to go out in the garden and enjoy some of our gardens. Tell us about some of the things that we should be doing at this time of the year.
Okay, basically, as I said, you must make sure that you don't water in the heat of the day. That's certainly one thing. And when you're planting anything, you need to soak it in a bucket of water for a few minutes until the bubbles stop to make sure that whatever plant it is, whether it's a seedling or a pot plant or a shrub or a ground cover, first soak it in a bucket of water to make sure that it's properly wet so that when you've transplanted it, at least you know it's wet and firm it down well and then water it. And if you've had plants that you've planted recently, just before the sudden heat, you can actually take the hose pipe and create rain on them. And when I say rain, I mean putting your finger in the front of the hose pipe and actually making a shower over the plants just to sort of cool them down, because they've got holes in their leaves and they lose water through those holes. So by cooling them down, it's like literally putting yourself under the shower, the same effect. So it will certainly cool the plants down by doing that.
So what we're looking at is a sort of misting effect where you'd mist them as opposed to just watering them down.
That's right. You should water at the bottom on the ground, but then also mist them just to cool them down so that they don't lose so much water.
A question is coming in, you know, with the intensity of the heat we have, and we have those large tracts of in our gardens, that's water guzzlers, that's the lawns. Take us on through some of that.
I discussed the lawns last time, and I'll just repeat that. In my personal opinion, the Kikuyu lawn is one of the worst water guzzlers, as we call it. What one can do is try and reduce the lawn area, or alternatively plant different types of lawn, for example, the LM lawn, because that doesn't require as much water as the kikuyu. And of course, not to cut your lawn as short as you normally would, because by keeping it longer, it won't scorch as easily. Because if it's very short, with a sudden heat, the lawn tends to scorch very quickly. And then, of course, people want to put more water on to keep it greener.
Now, whilst we're talking about the lawns that we have, the patches that we do have, and what would be a good way of watering them? I know it's deep watering, but take us to some of that routine.
Basically, a sprinkler, those orange sort of, what shall I call them, tortoise-like sprinklers, those flat orange sprinklers, they seem to give the most effective amount of water if you leave it on for about 10 minutes per spot. And again, early in the morning and not in the heat of the day, that certainly will make a difference. And obviously, you'd have to cut down a bit on your fertilizer, because applying fertilizer, you're going to have to water so much more. So whilst people want a green lawn, just cut back a little bit on the fertilizer so that you're not going to have to water as often as you normally would. And as I say, don't cut it as short as you normally would. Leave it a slightly longer. You must never remove more than a third of the blade length at any one time when you're mowing your lawn.
The question, and something I've seen happen quite often, is that some people sort of leave the sprinkler on for that area to be damming up. So once that area is dammed up, there'll be lots of water, and then they move it to the next spot. Would that be a good idea?
It isn't a good idea to let the water dam up, because first of all, you're wasting water, and also there's a chance of diseases, you know, funguses setting in because it's damp all the time. And I also find that lawns that are very well, or at least overwatered, you tend to have problems with mole crickets. They're sort of browny pink crickets, and the areas that have a lot of water, they seem to have more mole crickets than people who rely purely on the rain for their lawns.
Wow, that's a fantastic observation. So when you do water, and you overwater perhaps, and you're then inviting the unwanted hohos into your garden, like the mole cricket.
That's right, yes, and also fungus diseases, because the roots are remaining constantly wet, which isn't a good thing.
Now, this time of the year, with the heat that we've got on, we're going to have lots of challenges with fungi and other sorts of insects. Take us through some of that.
Yes, with the heat, you'll find that you'll have lots of new shoots, and then you'll have aphids coming. Aphids are tiny little green insects, and they love the new shoots. They actually suck the sap out the plants. One will also get scale and mealybug. Scale looks like round little hard things on the plants, often brown, sometimes white. On the aloes in particular, you get long white scale, and they look almost like rice grains, if I can call it that. And then, of course, one's got the diseases like the powdery mildew, which comes particularly on the roses. Normally one gets it only from about November, but because it's hot so early this year, one will find you'll get powdery mildew diseases. And also the mealybug, which looks like fluffy cotton wool. And often I find gardeners find it very difficult to distinguish between mildew and mealybug. And one way to tell for sure is to actually squash that cotton wool and see if there's blood. And if there's blood, the chances are that it's mealybug. Whereas if there's no blood, then it's a disease, meaning it's possibly mildew.
Well, so you squash it between your fingertips, and if you do see some sort of red residue, you would assume then that would be a mealybug.
That's right, yes. But some gardeners are very squeamish about that. When I say to them, squash it and see if there's blood, they sort of say, oh, no.
Well, I was just thinking about someone. Well, the next thing you say, well, what happens to the worm is there? Because I know people are very squeamish about worms and so forth. Well, now we're going to look at some of the queries that have come through as well, and that's with regards to containers. You know, we have people who are you know, gardening in containers, and with this heat, I think there's more care that has to be taken, because they dry out easier. Is that right?
They do. They tend to dry out a lot quicker. And I think one of the reasons is that people tend to put containers around the poolside or the entertainment area, and often there's paving, and that just seems to attract the heat. So the containers certainly do dry out a lot more. And what people need to remember is, first of all, when you're watering them, to give sufficient water that it runs out the bottom, so that you haven't just watered the top section, because the roots are near the bottom, so one needs to make sure that the whole thing is properly wet. And obviously a mulch on the containers would also make a difference. And if you're in a position to move the containers to a slightly cooler spot now in this heat, that would also help. And that goes for people that go on holiday. When you go on holiday, try and move your containers to areas that aren't in the full blazing sun, because that will certainly make them not dry out as quickly.
We've got a call in line. Let's say that one before we continue. Hello, assalamu alaikum. Hi. Hello, assalamu alaikum. Don't know if the person's still on.
I just want to know that I haven't pruned my fruit trees, that was apricot, plums, and peaches. I haven't pruned them, and now they are full, very full. But I'm afraid I haven't even sprayed them, that they are going to be full of worms when they... Is there anything I can do now?
Where are you calling in from?
From Laudium.
From Laudium. So you've got all the, you know, you've got the apricot and the plums and peach
the
trees.
And the prunes, yes.
And you haven't pruned them, and they're now in full bloom.
Yes.
And you want to know what precautions to take.
Yeah, right. I wonder if it's not too late.
Okay. You listen off, Eben.
Yeah.
They're in full bloom. They're not in fruit yet.
They're in fruit yet. They're in fruit. They're full.
If they're in fruit already, unfortunately, it's too late, because what one is supposed to do, as soon as 3/4 of the blossoms have dropped, yes, that's when you need to start spraying against fruit fly, and you spray every 2 weeks, and on the pamphlet of whichever product you've chosen to use, there's a waiting period from when you've last sprayed before you can harvest. But unfortunately, the fact that the fruit's already there, it's a bit late to spray for fruit fly.
It's a bit late.
Yes.
And the fact that I haven't pruned them, that it will make a difference.
No, that shouldn't make a difference, because it's also too late to prune them now because the fruit is already there. All you can do is possibly thin out the fruit, that there's less fruit, so that the all the food can go into those few fruits that you've left. Instead of having 20 fruit on a branch, you know, thin it down to 10 or so. So sort of remove half of the fruit. That will certainly give it more space to develop.
Yeah, because I see the apricot trees on one branch, there's about 30 apricots.
Sure,
I've never had
amazing.
It like that before.
Well, I think what we do understand is maybe if you would thin it out, it would give you better fruit, and you know, you've got to just make sure that you take it out.
Thank you. Jazakallah so much. Thank you.
Jazakallah for your call. Thank you. So we were talking about moving containers, and you said that it's advisable in midsummer, especially if you're going on holiday, to move these containers. Now, some of them are very large and won't be able to be moved. And I've also seen the trend, and it's a very, you know, a trend that you see more and more, that people who are elderly are now, you know, reverting or getting back into the garden, but using containers because they cannot perhaps bend anymore, or not, you know, their bodies don't allow them to do that. So, you know, they would then prefer, because they still want to be out in the garden, to plant in containers.
Yes, now containers are definitely a good way of planting, especially for the elderly, and almost any plant can be planted in a container. There's a misconception that people think only certain plants do better in containers. I personally always recommend evergreen plants for containers, for the simple reason that you put them in strategic spots, so you're looking for things that are looking nice the whole year through. And obviously your colour, you would be planting in containers as well to have it closer to the house.
Yeah, so we're looking for that wow factor when you're looking and you're planting in containers. So when you come in, it's just one particular thing and it stands out. And it's something that it distinguishes from the rest of the garden.
That's right. It's sort of a focal point almost.
Okay, so that's with regards to containers. Whilst you're still with containers, I know that we've done this and people keep on, you know, wanting to know what type of foods can we plant in containers? That's vegetables. Is it any type or certain types?
Most of the veggies you can. Tomatoes, brinjals, the chilies and the peppers, they do exceptionally well. Even the lettuces and spinach. What one has to remember is that you just need to make sure your soil is prepared properly. If you use the standard ready-mix potting soil that you buy from the garden centers, that's normally ready-mixed so you can use it as is. And if your container is very deep, what you can do, you need a layer of drainage at the bottom. And what we usually use, because we believe in recycling, is the old polystyrene seedling trays that you buy your seedlings in. Break that up and put a layer of drainage at the bottom. And also, that's not as heavy as if you would put stones at the bottom, because then you wouldn't be able to move your containers around. But most veggies do very well. And then I'd also like to mention that there are also a few new, what they call patio veggies available. There's a miniature cucumber and a miniature tomato and a miniature brinjal, which are more compact plants, obviously with also slightly smaller fruit, but they're also better suited to containers. But again, one has to remember that the containers do dry out a lot quicker.
Just on that, do you ask for patchouli veggies, or is there a specific name, or do you just say you want baby veggies? How would you distinguish them?
The brinjal is called patio baby, and the cucumber is called patio snacker.
Wow.
And then the tomato, you get various dwarf tomatoes, all sorts of different names, but they're dwarf plants.
Thank you very much all for that one. So we have some. The question with regards to seedlings and seeds, it's too late for seeds, is it?
It is a bit late for seeds, yes. You know, the next sort of seed, unless you're in a frost-free area, you could still put in some seeds, but generally the seed planting time is sort of more August, September. It is getting a bit late for most of the seed.
And what about bulbs? Is that far too late for any bulbs?
No, bulbs you can still put in. Gladiolus can go in, the huge amaryllis bulbs. They're actually really very showy. And the nice thing about the amaryllis is that you can actually time their show. They take 6 weeks to flower from when you plant them. So if you've got a particular function on and you'd like them in full bloom, you sort of work back from that date and you plant them 6 weeks earlier, and then you're almost guaranteed that they'll flower at the right time. And then, of course, the dahlias, which are lovely for cutting for the vase, they're also the right... It's the right time to plant them now as well.
So you could plant dahlias, the amaryllis, and the gladioli.
That's right, yes. Yeah, most of your summer bulbs you can still put in now.
And do you have a cut-off point for them, or is it just end of October or end of November?
Yes, I would say sort of end of October, middle of November is the absolute cut-off for them.
Okay, so that's with regards to the bulbs. Let's just go back now to some of the other things we spoke about. And I've got a question coming through about... the garden insects, you know, those that would be detrimental to the plants. Any particular precautions that we should be taking? We've spoken about the heat and spoken about the water. Anything else?
Not really. Unfortunately, a lot of the things, particularly the diseases like the powdery mildew and the black spot on the roses, they're weather-related. So the minute we have this exceptional heat and then the overcast days in between, that brings on the diseases. So there's not much one can do except one can spray preventatively. With these fungus diseases, one can spray as a preventative measure. And with the insects, you can't really spray preventatively. With the insects, you need to wait for them to actually be there and then try and sort the problem out. The only thing is one needs to be very careful if it's on your herbs and your veggies, because obviously you can't use any insecticides when you're going to be harvesting things for eating.
With regards to flowering plants, we've had the about five seasons, and I think we've spoken about this on a number of occasions with regards to the impatiens. Is there any other plants that we could, or we should be wary of?
No, not really. It's basically the impatiens that are a problem with the fungus that they get. But again, it's weather-related and it is in the air, so one will get it. You can spray preventatively for it, but it will then still come when the weather conditions are right. But normally, if you keep to a regimental spraying program, you'll find that your impatiens will only get the fungus probably towards the end of February. Whereas if you're not spraying for it, you'll get it sooner. And one must remember, just like what you practice crop rotation in your veggie garden, the same thing applies to things like the impatiens that get the disease. If you're planting impatiens every year in the same soil, your chances of it becoming more of a problem is much greater. Whereas if you skip a year or two, you will find that the problem is probably not as quickly to show itself as normal.
You know, you spoke about two things that I want you to help us about. You know, you spoke about regimental, and I think it's important that people understand that there are certain things that has to be done. And I can't just but help of, emphasize this particular point with regards to watering and feeding and over and under watering. I think these are things that are critical to any planting that you do, whether it is food planting or just for aesthetics. These are things that are important.
No, that is true, Ishmael. If one's watering and feeding, you need to do it. If you choose to feed, it depends on your particular product you're using, but if they say every 2 weeks, you actually need to do it every 2 weeks, and you need to make sure that you water your plants regularly. I find a lot of people make the mistake of watering every day, and obviously with seedlings, they need a lot more water, but I'm talking about general garden plants. You should rather water once a week properly than a little bit every day, because all you're doing by watering every day, you're encouraging shallow roots. Whereas if you water once a week but you do it regimentally, you'll force the roots to grow deeper. But obviously in this heat, one has to adjust your watering, and perhaps those that have got automatic sprinkler systems, you might need to adjust the time that your sprinkler actually sprays to compensate for this exceptional heat we're having at the moment.
And, you know, talking about, you know, the water, whenever you talk to people, you said you bought lots of, and you spent, you know, quite a fortune on plants. And one of the things that you find always lacking, or in most instances lacking, is feeding. You know, they think, well, water is enough to feed, and that's all you need, just water. And I think that's a misconception.
No, it certainly is. A lot of people say my orchid's not flowering. That's an all-time favorite. My orchid's not flowering. And then I say, have you actually fed it? Oh, no, I didn't know it must get food. You know, all plants at some stage will need some food. They will need nutrients. And particularly if your soil is on the poor side, and the only way to improve your soil is to add a lot of compost, because compost will actually enrich your soil. And then, of course, one has to add fertilizer. There are organic fertilizers available, as well as the chemical fertilizers, and depending on what type of plant, you would then determine which one you would need. For example, if you're talking about flowering and fruiting plants, you would need a fertilizer that's got a high potassium content, so in other words, something like a 315, where the last number is high, because it's the potassium that actually encourages the fruit and flower. So that would be perfect for your tomatoes, your brinjals, your peppers, things like geraniums and roses. Whereas if you have more leafy foliage plants in your garden, like cycads and palms and delicious monsters, and more sort of a tropical leafy garden, then you would opt for a fertilizer that's got a lot more nitrogen in, for example, something like a 3-2-1 or a 7-1-3, where the first number is very high.
Now, you know, you may have a person, I know that for that as well. You know, I cannot sort of buy all of these. I don't know which one is to put in at what time. Do you have any, is there any one that would sort of do the job of all of that?
If I had to recommend one fertilizer, I would say an organic 315 is a fairly good general fertilizer, because it's got quite a bit of nitrogen in and it's got a lot more potassium in for the fruit and flowers. And what it also does, apart from encourage fruit and flowers, it also strengthens the cells against the winter. So it's really a good all-round fertilizer. So if you only could afford to buy one, that would definitely be the one that I'd recommend, an organic 315.
An organic 315. You also mentioned something about crop rotation. Why is it important?
It's basically for soil-borne diseases. That's the main reason. And also, if you're planting something like beetroot and carrots, if you add fresh kraal manure to those beds and you plant things like beetroot and carrots or your root crops, you'll find that they have lots of small hairs. Whereas if you've had another crop, either beans or lettuce, in that spot where you've put the fresh manure in, by the time you plant the carrots or the beetroot the following season, that manure sort of had a chance to work its way into the soil properly. So that's basically the reason for crop rotation. It's more for diseases and to make sure that the nutrients you're adding have already been absorbed into the soil.
Question coming through, I've got limited space, and how do I do crop rotation? Do I dig out all the soil every year because I don't have that amount of space, and then, you know, to plant, I beg your pardon, you put in lots of compost? Would that solve the problem?
Compost will certainly make a difference. It will improve your soil. But for crop rotation, whether your area is small or large, what you need to do is you need to make sure that you don't plant the same crop on the same soil season after season. So in other words, where you had your lettuces, you now plant your carrots, and you sort of move it on. So if you could imagine a door, the size of a door, a 1 by 2 meter area, you would plant your lettuces and then your beans and your carrots and make sure that you don't plant the same crop on the same spot every year, that you actually rotate the position.
And that would do for all plants, or is that just the food that we're talking about?
It's mainly for your food, and then your particular few plants, like the impatiens that have picked up a problem with the fungal diseases, and possibly even the petunias, because a few years back there was also a problem with the fungus on the petunias. But in general, it's a good thing to practice crop rotation for the simple reason to stop your diseases from developing.
Now, the question coming through with regards to a banana tree, how do I look after it?
An eating banana or an ornamental banana? I would assume we're talking about an ornamental banana.
It doesn't sound very clear, so I'm not sure.
Yes, they like a fair amount of water, and they do frost down in winter if one's in a frosty area, but they do shoot again, and one can certainly feed them with something like a 315, so they do require a fair amount of water, and in most instances they seem to do a little bit better where they get a bit of shade, particularly the harsh afternoon sun, to keep that off them.
Question coming through with regards to, you know, I'm wanting to plant a tree that bears nuts, which one do you recommend for Johannesburg area?
Depending on the size of the space available, but the pecan nuts do very well, and of course the almonds and walnuts as well. The macadamias could be a problem because of the frost, but the pecans, the walnuts, and the almonds will be 100%. The pecan one, must just remember, is a big tree. It reaches about 15 meters in height.
Wow.
And probably about 7 or 8 in width, so one really needs a big garden for that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We're going to go for the news break. When we come back, we'll continue. We're going to be talking about indigenous plants, and I've got some queries with regards to some herbs as well, so we'll take all of that after the news break. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's dear to be different. My name is Ismail Vriyava. Just wonderful to have you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming Midway 1548 and Satellite Islam. And we've got a wonderful guest, and that's Michelle Kudze, and she's been sharing some wonderful information with us. Hi, good morning, Michelle.
Morning, Ismail.
Thank you very much. I just received an alert from the Johannesburg City Council. Can I just share it with our listeners and with you as well with regards to the heat?
Sure.
Okay, it says that Joburg has experienced one of its hottest summers in recent memory, with temperatures regularly touching the 35 degrees Celsius mark. A prolonged heat wave can affect the health and well-being of people, with elderly, young children, and people who work outdoors especially at risk. However, there are some proactive steps that can be taken to reduce the risk of exposure to the sun rays and keeping cool during the coming months of summer. The first one they speak about is drink more water and stay hydrated. Other liquids such as energy drinks are also acceptable, but water remains the best option. And remember, Joburg's tap water is rated amongst the best quality in the world. The second point, keep the sweat away. Wear loose-fitting and breathable clothing such as cotton and apply antiperspirant even at night when you go to bed. If you venture outdoors, use an umbrella and wear a sun hat. The next one, keep your food cool and avoid the oven. Go for foods that not require heating, such as salads, cold meats, and even cold soups. Enjoy cold treats such as ice cream and popsicles. Continue exercising. Be cautious of overexerting yourself and schedule your workout for the coolest times of day. If you are cooling yourself in the swimming pool, don't stay too long. Cool your room down without expensive air conditioners. Open the windows to allow the air to circulate. And this one I think is very important. Ventilate your car. Temperature inside the car that has been standing in the sun can be up to 10 degrees higher than the outside. Roll down the window on the one side and open and close the door on the opposite side for a few times to fan the interior. Know your body's cooling points by applying ice cubes wrapped in a towel at certain places such as the wrist, neck, elbow, ankles can reduce body heat quicker. Watch out for granny, youngsters and pets. Older people and children are most vulnerable to soaring temperatures. Look after them with particular care and don't leave children locked in the car. I'm going to repeat that, and don't leave children locked in the car while doing shopping. Allow them to play in an unused car where they possibly can lock themselves. Remember the sunscreen. When you're outdoors, apply lotion and high level of protection against harmful ultraviolet rays, and wear a sun hat that can protect both your face and neck, even when you are in the shade. And the final one is, watch out for the signs. Be aware of the symptoms associated with dehydration and overheating, such as muscle cramps, mild confusion, difficulty in breathing, weakness or sleep problems. Rest in a cool place, replenish your body with fluids, and consult a doctor or pharmacist if the symptoms persist. And there was an alert sent out by the Johannesburg City Council. Michelle, I thought it was important that we share this, because I know that looking at the weather reports coming in, they said that for the next few days, the intensity of the heat is going to increase.
Yes, no, it's very important. I don't think people realize how hot it is and how important it is to stay hydrated.
And importantly, you know, I've found sometimes we're so foolish, you know, sometimes you just want to leave your car, your little child in the car and say, I'll be back in a couple of minutes, not knowing how hot that car can get.
Yes, well, I was even surprised to hear that it's 10 degrees hotter than outside.
Yeah, no, so I mean, that does tell you a lot. And, you know, we've had recent incidences, you know, where we found that mum and dad locked the child up and they came back. The child was no longer alive, you know, that type of story. So we have a lot of that. And I also like the idea of cooling your room without air conditioning. Open the windows and allow the air to circulate. So we have a lot of these pointers. And I think we should be taking and be mindful of all these precautions.
No, certainly.
Well, thank you very much for that. And now let's go on to some of the other things that we were set out to discuss. You know, there's a misconception about indigenous plants. Now, Michelle, tell us, what's an indigenous plant?
An indigenous plant is a plant that is native to South Africa. In other words, it originates from South Africa. That's what indigenous. So, for example, in Australia, they talk about Australian natives. Here we talk about indigenous plant, which means it originates from here. It doesn't necessarily mean that it only occurs here, but it naturally occurs in this country.
We also have a debate about the purists who say it shouldn't also be, indigenous, but it should also be endemic. So it should be to that particular small area. For example, if you look at the fynbos, it is to that particular area of South Africa, not widespread. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Endemic means to a specific area, as you've illustrated the fynbos. The only problem with advocating to try and plant that way in our area, very much in the Free State sort of southern low high salt area, you would be planting grass because that's about all that's endemic to this area, you know. So I don't think it's the right thing to say try and plant endemic. You know, certainly there's a movement to planting indigenous plants, and I think part of the reason is to try and save our indigenous flora and, you know, for biodiversity.
Now, while you're talking about, you know, planting indigenous ones, in our part of the world, and that's Gauteng grasses and so forth, in other parts there's lots. But when you talk about, you know, indigenous would mean anything that comes from South, let's say Southern Africa as opposed to South Africa, is that right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. Mainly South Africa, but then also Southern Africa. And some people even cheat a little bit and plants that are indigenous to North Africa, they often include as indigenous as well, you know.
Okay, well, I suppose the world becoming globalized, we can say they're all fine. All plants belong to all parts of the world.
Exactly.
Well, that's just cheating. Now, you know, you've raised a very important point with, you know, plants that do well in our part of the world, and there's grasses. Now, grasses have become very fashionable and then got out of fashion and come back into fashion. Tell us, you know, why it's important that we plant grasses. And being indigenous, it does have a certain amount of beauty. The other question that we have, Michelle, is that people see indigenous as ugly, seeing that it has got no beauty, it's got no smell, has got, you know, the aesthetics are just not there. When you take, for example, the impatiens, or you take the orchid, or you take the roses, there's some beauty. Is that true?
No, I don't think so. Whilst there are a fair amount of scraggly-looking indigenous shrubs which need trimming back to sort of rejuvenate them to shoot again after the winter, there certainly is a lot of things, and I think the problem is people just don't realize which plants are indigenous. If you take, for example, geraniums, geraniums are indigenous to South Africa, and so are the Cape daisies, the osteospermums that have just all flowered now with the large daisy flowers early in spring. Your Namaqualand daisies are indigenous, gazanias, the blue kingfisher daisy, the Felicia, that's indigenous. Your agapanthus, which are all coming into bloom now, are also indigenous. The pineapple lily, which incidentally keeps away moles in your garden, the Eucomus, that's indigenous. It looks like a huge, a huge green pineapple. Your pin cushions, your proteas, your confetti bushes, even the Streptocarpus, which is, we call it the Cape primrose, that's really an attractive indigenous plant. Your Stolitzias, the Clivias, I'm thinking off the top of my head, yeah, the Octotus, the white arum lilies. There really are many beautiful indigenous plants.
Yes, whilst we, you know, have so many of them, some of them have been taken, and, you know, so I know that there's always been the battle between South Africa and Australia when it comes to some of these plants and people. And, for example, our own rooibos, you know, people wanting to claim that it belongs to them, and, you know, we have this debate of whether it is really part of that particular country or this country and so forth. So those debates continue.
Yes, no, certainly they do.
And, you know, whilst we're looking at that, some of the things we have to be protected, and I know there's lots of the medicinal plants that originate from South Africa, and you now have, you know, the pharmaceuticals coming in and say, well, fine, we want to take over, and they've taken them to their countries, and we have that battle as well.
No, we definitely do. Thinking off the top of my head, I can just think of three sort of herbs that are well sought after. The African wormwood, which they call in Afrikaans the wilde als, that's an indigenous plant, and quite an attractive grey-leaved plant. And the cancer bush, the Sutherlandia, with its orange flowers, that's also indigenous, as well as the bulbine, which is the one they use for bee stings. It works very much like aloe vera. It's got the gel in like the aloe vera, and you can use it on bee stings, you can use it on mozzie bites, and they're also indigenous. So there's a lot of good plants that are indigenous as well that are useful to us.
Now, having spoken about, you know, the different types of plants that we have, and would you be able to say that there's a fair amount that we could use in different parts of the gardens. We could use them as hedges, we could use them as trees, we could use them as ground covers, and plants that bring aesthetics into the garden.
Yes, no, definitely. We do have a lot of trees that are indigenous, and of course, I think the big problem is that people don't understand that one needs to remember, whether it's an indigenous plant or an exotic plant, I think you need to consider where the plant comes from and where it occurs naturally. For example, if we take one of the indigenous trees like the Combretum, the river bush willow, as the name suggests, river bush willow, it tells you that they occur next to the riverbanks, which means they require a lot more water. So obviously if you're planting that tree, it's going to need more water than something like a cabbage tree, the Cussonia, which grows on rocky outcrops in well-drained soil, or like a fern that grows in a deep shaded forest will need to be planted in a shady area and will require more water than something like an Immaculate Daisy that's used to the open south outside. So I think it's important to think of where the thing comes from originally and try and give it the same conditions. For example, if you're planting something from the Cape Fynbos area, whether it's a protea or a pincushion or a confetti bush, you need to make sure that you try and copy that, you know, those conditions. For example, they have an acidic, well-drained soil in the Cape, so you need to try and copy that in your garden. And I think by doing that, one will find that you'll be able to plant indigenous plants in the correct positions, and they'll probably do so much better than planting something that's in a shady plant like a clivia in full sun is obviously not going to perform as well as it would in a shady area which is its natural environment.
So important is to mimic that environment, just make sure that it looks like that particular environment and, you know, has the same conditions so that we'll get the best out of that plant.
Yes, most definitely. And it's unbelievable. I was making a list while you had the news on, and there are so many ground covers that are indigenous, and they really have very showy flowers, a lot of them in spring, others throughout the summer months. And one can really have quite a showy garden using just indigenous plants.
And could you list perhaps some of the ground covers that we could use? Because one thing about I don't know if that's a misconception. I beg your pardon? That's a misconception, but, you know, if you have these indigenous ones, there's less care and not so much watering.
Some of the varieties, the ones that are used to open, sunny, felt areas, yes, certainly. But as I say, others that are used to sort of growing on the banks of rivers and so on, they will definitely need more water. But these that I'm going to list now are sort of water-wise indigenous plants. They certainly can handle the heat and require a lot less water. First of all, the kingfisher daisy, the Felicia. Then your gazanias, they make large daisy-shaped flowers which actually close in the late afternoon. They need full sun to open. Your Nemaquilan daisies, the Octotus, which is very similar to the gazania, but it's a little bit more frost-tender. Then your Nemesia, they flower normally early in spring. They're quite short, probably about 250 millimeters. Your Diasia, I think they call it a twin spur. And your osteospermums, the Cape daisies, they're really very attractive. And even some of your fahies, the Osana, has quite thick fahie-type leaves with a yellow daisy flower. And Bacopa or Sutera, that's had a name change, that makes a tiny little daisy flower, like what a kitty would draw a daisy. That's what their flowers look like. And, of course, your geraniums. Even hen and chickens are indigenous, and they prefer more shady spots. And your Agapanthus. And then going a little bit higher, more sort of for perennials in between, your wild garlic is indigenous, as well as your clivias, but they're for shady areas. Your arum lilies are indigenous, your watsonias, the dietes, which is your wild iris and your rain lily, as well as your red hot pokers and dioramas. They call them the fishing rods. And as I mentioned earlier, the pineapple lily as well.
You know, I've got a quick question coming through with regards, where is the cancer bush available from?
Most garden centres should have it at the moment because it is their time to be in the garden centre because they're flowering at the moment.
Okay, is there any added value to them or is that just the name given to them?
No, they certainly do use it. I believe they make a tea from it which they use for cancer.
Okay, and the wild garlic, is that also available quite freely?
Yes, the Tolbachia, yes. You get it in sort of a plain green and a variegated foliage, and then they have the purple-scented flowers. And, yes, it's quite a common plant, and it should be available in any garden center.
And is that edible as well, medicinal or culinary?
No, not at all.
No.
Not culinary, not edible at all. It's purely for its aesthetic value.
Okay, so it's not culinary at all. I've got a query with regards to a herb called the senna. I think it's S-E-N-N-A. Any information with regards to that particular herb? Do you know about it? Do you know if it's available?
I'm not familiar with that one at all. I must be honest, I'm not an indigenous expert for the simple reason that a lot of them don't grow in our area because of the frost. So I'm not familiar. I think it's a type of cassia, if I'm not mistaken, but I really cannot give you any information on it because I'm not familiar with it at all.
Okay, thank you for that one. And one question coming through, I'd like to grow a low growing hedge that's indigenous. Any idea?
The confetti bush, the Collionema, would work, and Rhamnus, which is called your dogwood, but unlike your Cornus dogwood, this is an indigenous dogwood, a very nice, bright, shiny green foliage, so it's Rhamnus, R-H-A-M-N-U-S, Rhamnus. That can be trimmed back to form a hedge.
Okay, so that's the hedge one. I've got a spot that's very dry and a bit rocky. What do you suggest I plant?
Your Cape fynbos, provided you're not in a frosty area, your Cape fynbos does very well in well-drained soil, as does your confetti bush, and even your Octotus and Gazanias and your Felicias, they'll also all be very happy in that well-drained soil.
Another question coming through. There's a number of herbs, and we've spoken about the herbs that have to be planted. What would you suggest I plant, culinary or medicinal herbs?
I certainly would vote for culinary because it's so nice when you use fresh herbs in your stews and in your pastas and things. It gives so much flavor when you're using fresh herbs in your cooking, so that would definitely get my vote.
And when you want to plant herbs, is this the right time? Is it too late? Should we plant from seed or should we plant from seedlings?
It's a bit late for the seed, so seedlings at this time of the year would probably be best, and most of them prefer well-drained soil and full sun, and what one must remember with herbs is that they grow very quickly, so if you're planting herbs, you need to use them regularly, because they really are very fast growth. Things like basil and thyme and even coriander, they're really very fast growers, so one needs to pick them regularly.
With regards to basil, you have a number of varieties. Which is the best?
I would opt for the normal sort of plain, what they call sweet basil, the plain green sweet basil. You do get other varieties, but we find that that one just seems to have the most flavor, and it also does well. It performs well. It grows very quickly, and one can pick it regularly. And what one must remember with the basil is you need to remove the flowers so that they don't go to seed, so that you can sort of prolong the crop of your basil.
Another question coming through. I've got the spinach going on for more than a year now. Is it time for me to pull it out, or should I let it continue?
It does sound a bit long, if I may say so. I think a year is sort of maximum for spinach, because otherwise you'll find that you won't get such nice leaves anymore. It won't sort of be fresh young leaves anymore. You probably find that the taste won't be as good as what it would have been if it was fresh.
Thank you for that one, and something just checking here. With regards to the, not too sure, I'm just looking what it says here. You speak about something that can be used as a gel. What was the name of that particular plant?
Bulbine or Bulbanella.
B-U-L.
And it's got a thick gel, very much like aloe vera. And as I said, they use it on insect bites. For bee stings, it's wonderful. And it's a succulent, an indigenous succulent. So it looks very much like a fahi. And you get a variety with an orange leaf and a yellow leaf. So it's Bulbine or Bulbanella.
Bulbine or Bulbanella.
That's right, yes.
And that is available at nurseries?
Yes, yes.
Okay, next question coming through. The sugar plant, is that available?
Sugar plant, it is the right time of the year. The nurseries that stock herbs should all have it, and they call it stevia.
Okay, stevia. And stevia, is that something that perennial or annual?
In the warmer areas, it's perennial. In the frosty areas, it's annual. But depending on how much shelter you give it for the winter, if you cover it, you can get it to reshoot the next year, because it is actually perennial. But it all depends on the frost. And for those that don't know, the diabetics use stevia because it doesn't push up your blood sugar.
Any idea how to use it?
They use the dried leaves, and then you can also buy stevia extract at the health shops.
Okay. And finally, we're going to come to the end of the program. What do you have on special for us this week, Michelle?
Oh, we have quite a few things. We have roses on special. We have indigenous polygala, which is the num-num. I have got fertilizer for roses on special, bougainvilleas for those that like tropical gardens. And I've got some herbs on special at the moment as well. And geraniums as well, and fertilizer for the lawn. And then next weekend we have a two-day huge special. So those that are nearby must please not miss out on that.
Okay, and just a final question coming through. Berries, are they all available? Blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, mulberries, which is available?
Berries are much more readily available than what they used to be, but they're still difficult to find. Blueberries and blackberries and strawberries are probably the ones that they're going to be finding most of in the garden centres, and Cape gooseberries.
Okay, thank you very much. And finally, your situation, whereabouts are you situated?
We're on the northern side of Vereeniging, just about 10 minutes away from Roshni. So if you're coming from Johannesburg, you would pass Roshni on the left, and the second traffic light, you turn right, and we're down that street.
Well, you take care. Thank you. Everything of the best, and be careful with the heat. You're out in the heat most of the day. Take all the necessary precautions. You take care.
And enjoy the sun, and remember the hat and the sunblock.
Thank you very much. We'd all do that. You take care, Michelle.
Thanks. Thank you, Ismail. Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Michelle Kuzir telling us about what is to be done in the garden at this particular time of the year. Spoke about some of the herbs, some of the plants, and lots of indigenous plants that we can put into our gardens. Remember that it's a misconception that indigenous is not beautiful. You have some of the most beautiful plants as well. And then she gave us some of, spoke about Bulbinella that many people would want to have in their garden. They call it a first aid in your garden on your doorstep. So those are some of the plants that we've spoken about. And then she has also given us some other precautions with watering and so forth. It's all from us until we meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't forget, if you are going out in your garden, please take the necessary precautions. Drink water. Make sure that you have a hat and cool yourself down if it becomes too intense. That's all from us, inshallah.